Yeah. Now, Hong Kong is listed as owning 9.5 billion. So you can say, well, okay, Hong Kong's a proxy for China. That may be the case, but it's worth also pointing out in these key facts. It says that Hong Kong, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, and Luxembourg are tax havens.
Yes.
And the Netherlands, Singapore, and Switzerland are also used to avoid tax. A Statistics New Zealand study showed that in 2010, large proportions of the foreign direct investment from the Netherlands, Singapore, Hong Kong, and tax havens was in fact from other countries led by the UK, US, Germany, and Canada. So in 2019, other tax havens with investments in New Zealand companies include Bahamas, Barbados, Bermuda, Channel Islands, which includes Jersey and Guernsey, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and Isle of Man. But the value of all their holdings has been suppressed as quote-unquote confidential. And under the law, if you're buying, if a foreign investor wants to buy something in New Zealand that's valued, a company that's valued at less than $100 million, they don't have to go through any of that oversight thing. They don't show up in the statistics, the figures. So to give an Auckland example, if, for example, the Sky Tower was on sale for $99.99 million, and somebody from China or America or Australia wanted to buy it for that price, that would not figure in any of the stuff that we're talking about. That would just go through as any other real estate transaction, like you or me selling a house or a flat or whatever. That is literally flying under the radar.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and...
On the phone from Christchurch in the South Island of Aotearoa, I have Murray Horton, and he is here to speak on Kafka, the campaign against foreign control of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and their website
www.kafka.org.nz. And you can link from there to the second one, which is called Watchdog. Our publication is called Foreign Control Watchdog, and that can be found simply by going to the links on the Kafka site rather than spelling out the online address for you. You can link to that and you get God knows how many years of issues of Watchdog.
Excellent. And so Murray has been in the game since 1969, and 1974 onwards he's been involved in the campaign against foreign control of Aotearoa, New Zealand. And so, Murray, you're battle-hardened.
Thick-skin, Tim.
Yes.
Thick-skin, maybe thick-head too, who knows?
Well, this is the challenge that we've got, because
yes,
we just got to keep doing it, because
right. We
need the young ones to step forward who are wise to carry on. So, Murray, you've been in this for some time. Can you just give us a quick appraisal for listeners to get an understanding of how you brought this campaign to focus on how we in New Zealand are losing our country?
Oh, okay. Well, very briefly, the history of Kafka is that, as I said, I started off in 1969 when I was 18. So I'm 69 now. I started off, and like a lot of people of my generation, involved with opposition to things like the war in Vietnam and sporting links with apartheid South Africa. Several years of those sort of activities, and a group of us here in Christchurch, plus others around the country, including in Auckland, decided that we needed to focus on economic imperialism as opposed to the sort of military manifestation of it, which was like Vietnam. And so we got together to organise a thing called the South Island Resistance Ride. It took place in 1975. It was a couple of busloads of people, including from Auckland and a number from Australia. Went around the South Island for 2 weeks visiting places which were representative of economic domination of Aotearoa, New Zealand, by foreign transnational corporations. One that's very much in the news right now, Tim, the Bluff Smelter. We went there in 1975. It was going back then. It's been our longest campaign for Kafka. A demand that that place be closed down was the biggest corporate bludger in New Zealand. We went to a whole lot of other places, and so after that was over, after that activity was over, we decided to keep going. And we've been, like the Energizer Bunny, we've been going and going and going ever since. And we are essentially a lobby group. We're a Christchurch-based group. We don't have branches around the country. and we keep our message quite clear so that we are not involved in issues like immigration, etc., because this is a topic, foreign control is a topic that can easily be hijacked and slip into racism if you're not careful. So we have no arguments with people from other countries. I happen to be married to one. So our concern is with foreign big business and their domination of virtually all aspects of the New Zealand economy, manifested in things ranging from land sales through to, as I said, the Bluff smelter, through to ownership of banks, news media. Virtually any sector of the New Zealand economy you care to think about is dominated by transnational corporations. They're called transnational because they used to be called multinational, but now transnational because they operate in more than one country. And in some cases, they operate right around the globe. The cases are the biggest. Some of those individual companies are bigger than the New Zealand economy.
This is right. We have to be really, really on the ball on this one.
Oh, yeah, they're big boys. I mean, you're talking the likes of the oil companies. And I mean, well, now, the modern sort of giant sort of companies like Apple and Google and Amazon and Microsoft, the digital companies, the computer companies, they're enormous. Anyway, you wanted a history of briefly of Kafka, so that's what happened. And we've been keeping going, and we have maintained that word, that line. That's not a racist line. It's please don't confuse us, for example, with New Zealand First. We're not involved in immigration, etc., so our policy is that New Zealand should be a self-sufficient economy, one where if you're going to have foreign investment, that it has to be for the benefit of New Zealanders, not simply to fill their own pockets. We basically, in many cases, we're sold a pup, to use a good old phrase. That we're told that these companies will bring in jobs, they'll bring in money, this, that and the other. They'll do everything, possibly even give us breakfast in bed. But usually, when the facts are examined, it turns out that they take more money out of the country than what they put in. They don't create jobs. In the case of course, the smelter, get back to them, they're going to put 1,000, more than 2,000 workers out of work because it now suits their interest to do that. And they do nothing to sort of improve New Zealand's debt position. So we consider them to be a net liability, not an asset to New Zealand. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're on about, and we've been doing it for a long time. I mean, our campaigns and things have evolved over the years. I'm right now in the process of organising for next Monday night a premiere of a film that was shot in the 1980s, in which I appeared, 1983, representing what was then called CAFCINS, Campaign Against Foreign Control in New Zealand. We became CAFCA in the 80s, later that decade, and this film is called Islands of the Empire. And it's all about New Zealand's military relationship with the United States. And we were involved in campaigning on that stuff back in the 80s. The film has been updated. We've updated interviews featuring, for example, Nicky Hager, myself, Keith Locke and Murray Leadbeater, both good Aucklanders. And that's being screened here next Monday night. And it's quite fascinating to sort of compare things back from when they were filmed in the 1980s to now. One of the people who appears in the original film, somewhat to my surprise when I saw it again, was Tim Shadbolt,
okay,
who you will have seen on the news in the last week virtually sobbing away about the loss of that bloody smelter because he's been mayor of Invercargill for 27 years. But when he was filmed, interviewed for this film, Islands of the Empire, it was the 1980s, and Tim was sort of a well-known protest leader. And there he is in the film talking about his role in protests against American military installations in New Zealand in the previous decade. So quite a fascinating exercise to watch the sort of young, middle-aged Tim Shadbolt talking about his activities as a protester. So I'm giving you that example of, as to how we have evolved. We're not now involved in that sort of anti-basis stuff. There was a separate campaign, a separate organisation spun out of Kafka back in the 1980s called the Anti-Basis Campaign. I also work for that. I'm the organiser for that. And we're best known for our 30-year-long campaign against the Waihopai spy base, Marlborough. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about Kafka. So yeah, to bring us up to date, I mean, Kafka's still going. We have a membership of several hundred members. It would be fair to say they're a sort of mature membership, as indeed am I at this stage. We've been going a long time. But the message still resonates. And as I say, within the last week, with the sort of announcement of the closure of the Tiwai Point smelter next year, the whole issue of foreign investment, the whole issue of foreign control is bang back front and centre in the media again. It's a subject that never goes away.
Thank you, Murray. This is excellent. Because it's an ongoing situation where cashed-up corporations and companies are able to come into New Zealand, scout around, check out the good deals, and then buy up land. And so what is the situation now when I see foreign direct investment or ownership of companies in New Zealand increase from $15 billion in March 1989 to $121 billion
Oh, yes.
At March 2019, almost 8 times? And as a proportion of the total output of our economy, our gross domestic product, it has risen from 22% to 40% of our gross domestic product.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Now, what you're quoting there, Tim, is Kafka's Key Facts. They're on our website, and I understand you're going to put a link up on your website to that, but they also exist in hard copy form, so if any of your listeners were interested in getting a copy, a piece of paper with all this material contained on it in one single sheet of paper, they can contact you and get our postal address and we'll send it to them. Good old-fashioned snail mail. But yes, what you're talking about is that, and these figures, by the way, are all put together and updated every year by my colleague Bill Rosenberg, who's the founder of Kafka and who just in the last few months has retired as the economist for the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, CTU, in Wellington. So, I mean, you get that. You get the sort of direct foreign investment has sort of increased from, as you say, from 89, which was when, who was the Prime Minister then? Probably Geoffrey Palmer, or David Lange or Geoffrey Palmer, right through until it was $15 billion then, and it's now $121 billion. And, I mean, right up-to-date figures here, 2019, last year, the Overseas Investment Office, this is a government body whose job it is to, quote-unquote, oversee foreign investment. So in 2019, the Overseas Investment Office approved foreign investment totaling $17.6 billion. So that's in one year, 2018-19. This is the most recent figures. We don't have 2019 to 2020 figures yet. We won't get them till next year. So the average of foreign investment approved in any given year through the decade 2010 to 2019 was $9.2 billion. So it's an average of $9 billion a year for the most recent decade up until last year. But in the last year of that, the most recent year for which we have figures, it's double that amount, or nearly double that amount, $17.6 billion. So it's not going away. It's not falling off. You asked about land sales. Okay, so 2019, the Overseas Investment Office approved the sale of 78,000 hectares of freehold rural land to foreigners. And that's actually down. That's actually down by several tens of thousands of hectares. The previous year it was 137,000 hectares. So it goes up and down every year. So if you want to talk about land sales for a minute, the Radio New Zealand last year, October 2019, did a very interesting study. We had no input into it, so they did all their own research. And that study was called Green Rush. And this headline, Foreign Forestry Companies and New Zealand's Biggest Landowners. So just to quote what they say, the four largest private landowners in New Zealand are all foreign-owned forestry companies. So that's from Radio New Zealand. And I assume you, like me, Tim, are an individual homeowner. So it says here, individual homeowners own very little of New Zealand's land mass. People who own 5 hectares or less of land, and I certainly own less than 5 hectares of land, collectively own about 1.5% of New Zealand. So that's you and me.
Yep.
The ordinary householder. Using a more stringent quarter-acre test, and I've actually got just under a good old-fashioned quarter-acre section in Christchurch, using a more stringent quarter-acre test and only counting individuals and entities who own 0.1 hectares or less, that figure drops to less than 0.5%. So the amount of land owned in this country by mum and dad homeowners is 0.5%.
Yes, I mean, it's
right.
We're shrinking
and
down.
Whereas, by contrast, overseas forestry companies dominate the top four of the freehold landowners list, taking the first four places and account for 6 of the top 10 landholders overall. So the top four places are all of landowners, are all foreign forestry companies, and of the 10 biggest landowners in New Zealand, 6 are foreign forestry companies. And I'm trying to find some figure here of how much concentration of land. Oh, yes. Of the land that Radio New Zealand only looked at owned land, not leased land, right? So leased land is even more dominated. Of the land that Radio New Zealand did identify as privately owned, half was concentrated among a tiny group of 4,600 people or entities, equivalent to 0.1% of New Zealand's population. Right?
Yes.
So we're talking, you know, you and me, homeowners, Auckland, Christchurch, all of us in New Zealand, homeowners own 0.5% of the country, of the land in the country. 4,600 people, 0.1% of the total population, they own half of the land owned by the 10 biggest landowners.
Yes, well, it's when you put it that way, people have to understand that the tenancy, we have tenants in our own country at one level.
Well, that's entirely true, and that's interesting that you should use that phrase, and thank you for reminding me of that, because under our previous beloved Prime Minister, you may remember him, a gentleman called Sir John Key, back 10 years ago now, there was quite a big hoo-ha about a group of farms owned by a rather colourful man called Mr. Alan Crafer, the Crafer Farms in the North Island, and he wanted to flog them off, and it looked like they were going to be sold overseas. And Key wanted to step in and do something about that because he said he did not want New Zealanders to be, quote, tenants in our own country. Now, John Key said that, not Jacinda Ardern or Winston Peters. John Key said that. He didn't do an awful lot about it, but he recognised the feelings that New Zealand have for becoming tenants in our own country.
Well, it's
and it's not something unique to New Zealanders. It's a feeling that's held around the world.
It's a vote-getter for him.
It was a vote-getter for him, yes. And, I mean, it needs to be remembered that throughout the National government, the 9 years of National, that this issue of land ownership and foreign ownership of land was one that came up continuously, and they felt obliged to at least pretend to be doing something about it or look like they were. They didn't do an awful lot. The present government is actually doing something about it. Well, whether that's anywhere near enough is a whole different question. But, yeah, I mean, this issue of land sales is one that, as long as I've been involved in this whole issue, is one that's always been there. And opposition to it and disquiet about it runs right across the political spectrum.
Very much so. Now, who is the Overseas Investment Office?
Because they're just a group of
bureaucrats
located within what's called LINZ, Land Information New Zealand, which is a government department, and the minister in charge of land information is Eugenie Sage, who is one of the Green Party ministers in this government. But it needs to be noted that the Green Party ministers are all outside cabinet. So they're not actually, the cabinet is meeting today, as it does every Monday. There's no Green ministers attending that meeting because the ministers are exclusively Labour and New Zealand First.
Okay.
Eugenie is the Minister of Land Information, and there have been cases where she has actually, since this coalition government's been in power, there have been cases where she has actually said no to something. I'll give you one example. The mining company, the transnational mining company in Waihee. If you've been to Waihee, you know there's a great big hole smack bang in the middle of it.
Yes.
Open cast mine.
Mm-hmm.
And the company there, Oceania Gold, wanted to buy more farmland to dump more toxic waste.
I know.
Dump more toxic waste from the mine on it. And Eugenie said no, and she was then overruled by Labour ministers, the finance ministers, because they're more senior than her. So David Parker and I think David Clark. People tend to forget. Clark has been all in the news recently because he was the somewhat no-hoper Minister of Health.
Correct.
He's also an Associate Minister of Finance. And so Parker and Clark came together when the mining company went back to them. The mining company went over the head of Eugenie Sage, the Minister of Land Information, and went to the Finance Ministers, Labour, and got approval last year, 2019.
Yes, well, is it?
So, I mean, the Overseas Investment Office, I mean, if you ask me who, I can't tell you who they are. They're simply a sub-office within the Land Information New Zealand, which is a government department agency in Wellington.
Okay, are they just rubber-stamping corporate sales?
They used to be. They do a little bit more. To give them credit now, since the change of government in 2017, there has been this government, this coalition government, has been more serious about doing something substantive about foreign investment or foreign takeover. And so I get the newsletter, or CAFCA gets the newsletter, from the Overseas Investment Office, and they're now pointing out quite proudly that they have what's called an intelligence and monitoring unit within their office, which is to actually work out whether, if, for example, you turn up and say you want to buy something and you have conditions imposed on you, you're a foreign buyer, and you have conditions imposed on what you can do and can't do and what you're obliged to do, they have a unit to now actually see whether that happens. So they're now actually doing what they should have been doing decades ago and actually following up on this sort of stuff. And there have been some cases in recent years, in the last year or two, or since the change of government, of them actually, A, blocking people from buying what they apply to buy, or B, when somebody has bought something, they've been forced to sell it, and in some cases been taken to court and forced to sell the land because they haven't done what they said they were conditions that were imposed on them. And in one or two cases, they've been taken to court and fined, etc., because they didn't even go to the Overseas Investment Office to seek approval, which is compulsory.
Okay, very good. Now, can I ask, foreign investors own 21% or $4 billion
right.
of New Zealand's wealth.
Yep.
The commercial value is, the net value is $1.9
trillion. Oh, yes, I see that. Yep.
At March 2017. So, essentially, they own 24% of private net wealth.
That's right.
This is huge. And
that's the point we're making. New Zealand is, that we, CAFCA, are making, that New Zealand, Aotearoa, is one of the countries in the world most dominated by overseas ownership. And to put it into perspective, it's land sales are the things that get the attention and have the sort of emotional appeal. But, I mean, the four big Australian banks constitute an enormous chunk of the New Zealand economy. I mean, to quote from the same key facts that you're looking at, more than two out of every $5, this is money leaving, well, okay, let's talk about profits, and we'll see how much the banks make out of it. Transnational corporations make massive profits out of New Zealand. In the year to March 2019, the profits were $10.3 billion. So in the year from 2018 to 2019, they shipped $10.3 billion out of New Zealand. In the decade, 2010 to 2019, transnational corporations made $84.4 billion in profits from New Zealand, right? So
yes.
In those 9 years, 2010 to 19, $84 billion left New Zealand in profit. So when you see all this coverage in the media right now of how much money the government is throwing around right now to prop up the economy as a result of the coronavirus and economic crisis, put that into perspective. $84 billion left New Zealand in those 10 years. 1 year alone, March 2018 to 19, $10 billion left the country.
Yes, can I?
And on average, only 28% of the profits made by these companies was reinvested. And in that most recent year, only 25%. In other words, to explain that, of that $84 billion made, three-quarters of it actually left New Zealand.
Yeah.
Three-quarters of it went to whoever owned the companies, the banks, or whoever that owned it.
Okay, can I talk to banks at the moment? Because the four major banks, really, other than Kiwi Bank, are all overseas-owned.
They're all Australian-owned. Tracking down the ultimate ownership of those banks is a whole other subject, but, I mean, yeah, they're nominally, anyway, at least Australian banks. And it's worth pointing out that of the money that left New Zealand in that period, more than two out of every $5, or 42%, went to the owners of New Zealand's banking sector. These are serious money leaving New Zealand. So, yes, four banks completely dominate New Zealand's economy.
Because I remember about 30 years ago, ASB was a trust bank here in Auckland.
Well, Auckland Savings Bank.
Yes, the Auckland Savings Bank. And it was a very big bank. After the BNZ, which was New Zealand owned,
yes,
there was ASB, and the ASB sold it to the Commonwealth Bank in Australia.
Well, I mean, my pay account comes out of Westpac, and we, CAFCO, at least once a year, will get some highly indignant sort of person saying, why on earth are you banking with a bloody Australian bank? Well, the answer is quite simple. That when my pay account was set up for people to pay money into by direct credits, automatic payments, back in 1991, it was called the Canterbury Savings Bank.
Yes.
It then changed its name to Trust Bank Canterbury, right? A lot of work went into getting a suitable bank to put the account in. Come along 1996, they sold off to Westpac.
That's right, because I was in exactly the same situation. I too was in a trust bank.
Right.
And then we were absorbed by Westpac, and I was so upset, I just walked away from it. And,
right.
And so until, right up until this day, I just use that account. I'm in Kiwi Bank at the moment, which is...
Oh, you were in Kiwi Bank. CAFCA is a foundation member of Kiwi Bank. I have to say, they've picked up some of the bad habits of the foreign banks.
You bet.
they were the first one to sort of knock on the head accepting any payment, any deposits of cheques in February this year, which alarmed some of our more mature members.
Elderly, yeah.
So there was quite a lot of work to be done to set that up, and they also started charging a number of fees and things on things that they previously didn't charge fees on.
Yes, well, there's a lot of bad habits out there.
They've gone that corporate way.
Yes, they're all gone.
Yes, for what it's worth, CAFCA and me personally are foundation customers of Kiwi Bank.
Yes, yes. Well, can I...
And we supported that. And it's worth remembering, by the way, that when Jim Anderson was setting that bank up against the fervent opposition of Helen Clark and Michael Callan, it might be added, he wanted to call it the People's Bank. And that was obviously going too far. That was going to be the original working name of that bank. It was going to be called the People's Bank.
Well, Jim Anderson, we can always hold a flag up for him at that particular level.
That's right.
He definitely wanted for us New Zealanders to be more sovereign.
Well, absolutely. He got that through when the former alliance was in coalition with Labor, 1999 to 2002, and he did it over the objections of Prime Minister Helen Clark and Minister of Finance Michael Callan, who publicly sneered at the idea of Kiwi Bank.
I hear you. Now, just looking at the countries that actually have invested in New Zealand in a country order, you've got Australia's right up there, followed by Hong Kong, then USA, then Japan, then UK, Singapore, Canada, Netherlands, British Virgin Islands, China, Cayman Islands, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Germany, and France. These are the countries that are investing in New Zealand. And I just really want to draw attention to the fact that Australia's right up there.
Australia owns 50% of it.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at the actual visual representation of that on the key facts on our website, here we are here, overseas ownership of New Zealand companies by country, March 2019. So what do you call it, a pie chart?
Correct.
Australia, there's the total is 112, just under $113 billion. Foreign ownership of New Zealand companies. It's not land, companies. And Australia owns 50% of that total, $56 billion. To put things into perspective, I know people are alarmed by China. It's worth pointing out that China, Australia, $56 billion of ownership of New Zealand companies as of March 2019. China, $1.4 billion.
Okay, yeah, I think
it's a bit of difference.
Yeah.
Now, Hong Kong is listed as owning $9.5 billion. So you can say, well, okay, Hong Kong's a proxy for China. That may be the case, but it's worth also pointing out in these key facts, it says that Hong Kong, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands and Luxembourg are tax havens.
Yes.
And the Netherlands, Singapore and Switzerland are also used to avoid tax. A Statistics New Zealand study showed that in 2010, large proportions of the foreign direct investment from the Netherlands, Singapore, Hong Kong and tax havens was in fact from other countries, led by the UK, US, Germany and Canada. So in 2019, other tax havens with investments in New Zealand companies include Bahamas, Barbados, Bermuda, Channel Islands, which includes Jersey and Guernsey, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and Isle of Man. But the value of all their holdings has been suppressed as quote-unquote confidential.
Okay, let's go into this.
There, Hong Kong, $9 billion worth of ownership of New Zealand companies, you might think, oh, well, that's just the Chinese doing it through another way. Well, possibly, but also Hong Kong is a so-called financial hub for the world. It's a place where people funnel their money through from countries like Britain, America, Australia, well, not so much Australia, but Europe, etc.
Yes, well, this $16.6 billion unable to be allocated to an industry because of this foreign direct investment, this being suppressed as being confidential, how can we allow that, Murray?
Well, that's a good point. Very good point. In other words, you asked about the Overseas Investment Office. The Overseas Investment Office and the government sees their role as serving not us necessarily, but serving the interests of the foreign investors, right, who are their customers and clients. So the government, this government right now, is putting through legislation that they're amending the Overseas Investment Act. The Overseas Investment Act dates back to 1973 under Bill Rowling. Presumably you remember Bill Rowling, Minister of Finance under Norman Kirk, and then short-term Prime Minister of Labor. Anyway, so the Act goes back to there. It was last substantially sort of rejigged in 2005 under Michael Cullen, who was Labor Minister of Finance from 1999 to 2008, and this present government under the leadership of David Parker is pushing through an amendment to the Overseas, and they're amending the Act, and it's scheduled to go through later this year. After, it won't be before the election, but it's Parker's sort of publicity around this amendment makes it very clear that, with one or two exceptions, the function of the Act, the amended Act, is to make things easier for foreign and would-be investors to do business in New Zealand, not to make it harder, not to make it more in the interest of New Zealand people, to make things more smooth, streamlined, etc.
Yes, Parker has changed. I thought he was a very good person about 15 years ago, and I'm having my doubts.
Well, Tim, one point that needs to be clarified is that before we go any further, that these figures that we've been tossing around, under the law, if a foreign investor wants to buy something in New Zealand that's valued, a company that's valued at less than $100 million, they don't have to go through any of that oversight thing. They don't show up in the statistics, the figures. So to give an Auckland example, if, for example, the Sky Tower was on sale for $99.99 million and somebody from China or America or Australia wanted to buy it for that price, that would not figure in any of the stuff that we're talking about. That would just go through as any other real estate transaction, like you or me selling a house or a flat or whatever. So what you've got to bear in mind is that the figures that we're quoting here, all of them operate on the basis that it's more than $100 million. Involved in each individual transaction. And in fact, in the case of Australians, the figure is considerably higher. The Australian figure is $530 million. There you go. For private Australian investors, the threshold was $530 million in 2019, and it's adjusted upwards each year for inflation. It is $537 million in 2020. And for countries that are covered by a whole lot of individual trade deals in New Zealand, is a $200 million threshold. So we're talking about Australia owning, comprising 50%, Australian companies or whatever, comprising 50% of the total foreign ownership of New Zealand. That is Australian companies that have bought things up worth more than $500 million on present figures. So there's an awful lot under that that is literally flying under the radar.
I'm speaking with Murray Horton, spokesperson for CAFCA, Campaign Against Foreign Control of Aotearoa of New Zealand. CAFCA.org.nz. CAFCA.org.nz. CAFCA.
I'm just giving that as a sort of a qualification, that when you say, oh, gee, X number of billion dollars was approved to be sold last year, but yeah, there was also a whole lot of stuff that fell under that sort of threshold.
So does that mean if somebody comes over from Bondi and sees a beach section here and wants to buy it, they can buy it, and how does that come up in the government register?
Oh, well, they can't now. That's one thing that this government has done, and that's the first thing they did when they got in. This is the easy stuff. 2017, they imposed what was called the foreign house buyer ban. You may remember that. And so foreigners are not allowed to buy houses now. There are some exceptions. Well, actually, having said that, wait, I'll go back. I'm wrong. Australians can buy houses here. They don't have a problem. And also Singapore, people from Singapore were going to be covered by that foreign house buyer ban. They pointed out that they have a free trade agreement with New Zealand. And if New Zealand was to ban Singaporeans from being able to buy houses or apartments here, New Zealand would be in breach of the agreement and there would be legal consequences. So Singapore are allowed to buy houses here. But theoretically, there's this thing called the foreign house buyer ban, so that somebody can't come in from China or Japan or wherever and buy Auckland apartments, etc. As I say, there are some exceptions to that, but yeah. At that level, the government has done something. That's what attracted the attention in their first few months in office, 2017 through to 2018. But the big stuff, like the banks, for argument's sake, I mean, just on that one, in Australia, under a Conservative government, under the equivalent of a National Party government in Australia, they have had a Royal Commission of Inquiry into the finance sector, not only banks, but also in the same banks, the ones that operate here, but into insurance companies and superannuation companies, and came up with some incredibly damning findings. This Labor government in New Zealand has declined to do the same, despite the fact that there's plenty of reasons for sort of why banks should be investigated here.
Well, this is what I want to talk about. I mean, there's the Sun Alliance, the Guardian insurance companies, there's the Royal Exchange. There are all these different British corporations or insurance corporations that set up shop here over 100 years ago. Are they accounted for, the money that they're making? Because they're insuring so many businesses here.
Oh, well, I mean, the finance sector is the single biggest chunk of foreign investment here. Here we go. And the key facts again, the financial and insurance services sector, which includes the four big Australian-owned banks, accounted for by far the biggest part of foreign ownership of New Zealand companies by industry in March 2019, with $38.4 billion. Overseas ownership of New Zealand companies by industry, March 2019, I'm looking at a pie chart now, $113 billion. Financial and insurance services, $38 billion. All right? And the next biggest is manufacturing, $17 billion. So the outfits that you're talking about, which are primarily the banks, but not exclusively, but almost exclusively the banks, $38 billion out of $113 billion.
Well, we've got to look at the fact that we've got less than 5 million people in this country.
Right. We're a team of 5 million, Tim, as Jacinda tells us. Well, I mean, insurance companies, well, you're talking to somebody in Christchurch, you're talking to somebody who lived through 18,000 earthquakes. So don't ask Christchurch people about insurance companies. I personally, my wife and I don't have a personal hassle. We're insured with state and we didn't have a problem. But lots of other people did in the city. And the reason that, I assume you're a house owner, Tim, you're a property owner, the reason that you now have to pay, you have to say how much you want your house insured for if it gets knocked down as opposed to full replacement, is because of the Christchurch earthquakes. And because of the big insurance companies like State, which is owned by an outfit called IAG, Insurance Australia Group, they decided they weren't going to be paying out any full replacement anymore. If, for example, Auckland volcanoes blow up and cause a problem in Auckland, you have to tell them what do you think it would cost to rebuild your house, and that's how much money they'll pay you.
Yes, some sort of thing like replacement value.
Yes. I mean, full replacement value. Most people had those policies because those were sold. as gold-plated insurance policies, as you would know. And suddenly, when there were tens of thousands of houses in Christchurch flattened and people were claiming on those policies, the insurance company said, oh, OK, we're going to go broke here. Not going to make any money out of this. Disasters happen when people want to cash in their policies.
Yeah, well, the waters get very, very murky. I can assure you, they're muddied. And so this is a major problem. Yeah.
Going back, Tim, you were talking about the legislation, and we were talking about the actual legislation and the fact that the government is amending it. And you sent me a text last night saying that one of your listeners had asked you to ask me what three questions people should ask candidates for this year's September's election. Now, I had to think about this. I don't have three questions, but I have one. Politicians like responding to specific, not general, sort of, will you bring about world peace or something like that. But there is a specific thing that every candidate can be asked, and it's in relation to this. Part of the response, economic response to the COVID crisis, I'm talking about the economic crisis, the government rushed through a temporary piece of legislation called the Overseas Investment, open brackets, Urgent Measures, close brackets, Amendment Act. That's actually gone through. That's in force now. And one of the provisions of that was that every application by a foreigner, company or individual now, has to be run through what's called a national interest test. Labor, David Parker, was going to bring in this national interest test as part of its main amendment to the Overseas Investment Act. It's still working its way through Parliament, won't be enforced before the election. But that national interest test was much more highly specified, only applied to certain sectors of the economy, certain industries, and it only applied over $100 million. This thing, this so-called temporary measure, applies to everything. And the thinking behind it is that with a economic crash as a result of the virus, the value of New Zealand companies and assets, etc., will drop to the point where sort of foreign predators can move in and just scoop them up cheap and go. And virtually every other country on earth has bought in something similar, including, for example, our mates across the Tasman. Now, I'll get to the point. The government has made clear this is only temporary. It'll only last for a few months after the election. What people can ask their candidates is to insist that that national interest test be made permanent to all applications by foreign investors, be they to buy a farm or be they to buy the Auckland Harbour Bridge, has to go through that national interest test. So that's one thing that can be asked to all candidates. Do you agree to that? That it be made permanent? And the other one is that it be made to apply to the foreign investors, transnational corporations, already operating in this country. If it had been applied, for example, to the smelter and Bluff, they wouldn't have passed it. They wouldn't have passed the national interest test.
Yes.
They're a bunch of bludgers.
Yes.
If it was applied to the banks, the people we've just been talking about, I don't think they would have passed the national interest test either. So there is something, there's a two-part question that anyone can ask their candidate from any party, from the National Party through to the Green Party, and say, where do you stand on this?
Thank you.
If the government and our old mate David Parker has seen this as sufficiently important that they've rushed it through Parliament without any great opposition from National, I might say, because they have also seen that New Zealand business could just be, the value could just drop to sort of a fraction of what it was a few months ago and just be scooped up and gone.
Well, this is a big problem. You see, what it is in America and in China, they can get money just at a flick of their fingers. They can go and get loans from the States, come down here. This is what General Electric did way back after 9/11.
Right.
They came down to New Zealand, set up shop, and they were able to get loans for 2% in America. They came down to New Zealand and used this money, and they were able to collect 9% interest down here.
That's right.
And New Zealand has just rolled over and thought, oh, this is fantastic. We can still get cheaper loans than we can get from anywhere else in New Zealand. And so, again, this is a corporation coming into New Zealand and skimming us. It's continuous. Yesterday I was looking at the Green Rush, the foreign companies.
Oh, yeah, Radio New Zealand.
Yeah. Kate Newton, the journalist, and Guyon Espiner. I was very impressed with what they've done.
Oh, it's fascinating.
It is.
And if you go through the list of those 10 major, the 10 biggest landowners, one or two are Chinese, but they're not mainly. They're mainly, I mean, the biggest one, for example, is owned by a Canadian insurance company, I think. So, and there's Malaysians. Here we are here. So the biggest one, which I've never heard of, is the largest shareholder is a major Canadian insurance company. The second biggest is Malaysian. Third biggest is Australia. Fourth biggest is American. Then you get to a New Zealand one, and five and six in New Zealand, and then American. K Cayman Islands, well, that could be anybody, New Zealand and Auckland rich listers make up. So, yeah, it's very impressive, and they've done a lot of good research on that.
They have. Yeah, well, what I'm interested in about is how these large forestry units come into New Zealand.
Yes.
They buy it, and then they're planting not native trees.
Oh, it's all pine trees.
It's all Pinus radiata.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is being done with the encouragement of the government as part of its response to sort of, it started off as a supposed response to climate change to create a carbon sink, right? I mean, the ironic thing is, Tim, that New Zealand used to have its own huge forestry estate owned by you and me.
That's
New
right.
Zealand Forest.
Claimaroa Forest.
And they were all flogged off by our old mates, the names like Roger Douglas and Richard Preble and co, 30 years ago.
How about you?
30 years ago, and that started in the late 80s, and then was continued on by the succeeding national government of Jim Bolger and Bruce Richardson. So New Zealand had a world-class forestry estate of production trees flogged off.
That's right. Well, Harvard University got a big slice of that.
Yeah, they did, use their pension funds.
That's right.
Yeah.
Planting a hillside is very important to halt erosion.
Oh, yeah.
But really, it was previously all native bush.
That's right. I mean, pine trees are monoculture. There's quite a big movement at the moment among farming communities around the country that they're being wiped out by sort of land being sold and converted to forests. They don't need farm workers, they don't need schools, they don't need towns. Stick them in trees and leave them there.
Well, you see, this whole land grab in New Zealand, I mean, it's a sham. And this Labor government, like the previous national government, is making money out of it because money coming into New Zealand is added to our gross domestic product.
Right.
And the government books of the year shouts out, hey, we're making money, we're in profit.
Right.
Well, this is such a deceitful way of running a country, isn't it? I mean, we're selling off using non-native trees and then cutting these trees down 30 years later, exposing the hillsides again to erosion, exporting this offshore as logs with no added value or no value added.
It's just shipped out. I mean, it's, a lot of that is just piled up as logs on the wharves in ports like Tauranga or down here in Littleton.
Whangarei.
Auckland, Whangarei. And it goes out as basically raw material, right?
That's right. Well, there's no intelligence in it. There's no mindfulness or even reverence.
It's used for framing on construction sites in countries like China and Korea.
That's right. That's
Japan.
Right.
Although probably less of that now because, I mean, their economy has been knocked around. Everybody's economy has been knocked around by this virus. The other thing, Tim, the more general question that people can ask candidates is, this is a much more political philosophy question, is do you renounce the whole neoliberal economic model?
Excellent.
That's the one that's got us into the, it's got us into the manure. And we, New Zealanders, enthusiastically adopted that whole globalisation sort of approach, and we're paying the price. That we used to have a manufacturing base in this country. We made things ourselves. We were much more, we weren't self-sufficient fully, but we're certainly a lot more bloody self-sufficient than what we are now. I'll give you one example right here in Christchurch. There's one of the major projects being done as part of the rebuild of Christchurch City after the earthquakes. It was a thing called the Metro Sports Facility. It was a government, what's called an anchor project, not far from where I live, actually, just down the road. And it's been, they've announced that post, was very delayed in getting going, but they got it going. And they've announced that post lockdown and post COVID, it's going to be delayed by 2 years. Why? Because the relevant swimming pool that is going in there is being built in a factory in northern Italy. It was closed down because of the impact of the pandemic in northern Italy. And you tell this to people, they say, don't we make swimming pools in New Zealand anymore? Well, apparently not.
Well, you
so
see,
something in Christchurch is being held up because it was decided it would be actually better to get the bloody Olympic-sized swimming pool built in Italy.
This is the idiocy.
And I mean, we've become dependent, this country's become dependent on being at the end of a supply chain from China, right? China became the world's factory, and so the whole globalised world economy decided that they would get everything done through China. And another thing that happened during lockdown was I take medication for diabetes. They suddenly, all pills in this country became rationed during lockdown because the factories in India that were churning out the pills that supply New Zealand for all sorts of things, bang, they were sort of cutting down production.
Well, this is the problem of offshoring everything. You see,
we're that's right.
And this is where the big battle is at the moment with nationalism as against globalism.
Well, I mean, yes, exactly. Kafka defines ourselves as being a progressive nationalist organisation. nationalism is associated in the public mind with sort of, you know, right-wing, sort of reactionary, racist, etc. We see ourselves as none of those things. We see ourselves as representing a progressive nationalism and internationalism, but internationalism between people to people, not internationalism in the sense of just throwing your country wide open to corporations that are notionally headquartered in some other country, but in fact maybe based on some bloody island in the Caribbean somewhere where nobody knows who owns them.
Yeah, well, I want to go back to all these Australian corporations and companies. I'll bet you a lot of them are owned from the City of London.
Quite likely.
I mean,
Rio Tinto, the company that owns...
the Queen.
The Bluff Smelter.
Yes.
They routinely describe as Australian. Well, actually, it's British.
Yes, well, I hear that the Queen has actually got shares in Rio Tinto.
As I understand it, whether she does, I don't know, but I mean... Rio Tinto is a huge British mining company that, I mean, you will have heard, Tim, of the New Zealand played an honourable role in resolving the war in Bougainville on the island off Papua New Guinea.
Guitars.
Yes, that's right. Soldiers Without Guns. A very good film. Bougainville, the whole cause of the dispute there, was a mine owned by Rio Tinto.
Yes, I agree. They invaded that country virtually.
They did. And so they have a record all around the world, the big English, American and Australian mining companies. And so there's definitely Australia. I mean, the Rio Tinto is also in partnership in Tiwai Point and Bluff with Japanese, with Sumitomo.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're routinely, I mean, if you were to track back the ownership of the Australian banks, you would find, I think, their money comes from maybe American banks, etc. But I mean, for argument's sake, they are Australian banks.
Well, this is funny. During this COVID crisis, there was this guy who was locked down up in my area, and he came up to my house and he said, look, I want to know if I can find a flat to stay with because I can't get back to England. And his name was Peter Bale.
Right.
And peterbale.com. And he was the one who was behind the Panama Papers. He helped expose that. And here he was out in front of my house. This is the synchronicity of things. And so, yeah, if you look at peterbale.com, you'll find how he and a number of others exposed what was going on. And New Zealand is a clearinghouse for a lot of these corporations to anchor money in here.
Oh, yeah, there were so-called trust funds and all that, so trust companies and holding companies and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, you see, this is where we're donkey deep in so much stuff.
We've had a very laissez-faire, easy, you know, she'll be right sort of approach to capitalism, whereas the Americans, for example, the so-called world headquarters of capitalism, have a much more sort of, much tougher regime. They actually chase up some of these buggers and put them in jail, etc., but we don't.
Well, this is what's happened. Because we've sold the lie to the whole planet that New Zealand is the most honest country in the world to do business with.
Yeah.
And really, we've got to face it, Murray, we're not. And we're so sneaky, we're so clever in doing all these deals. And so I'm quite happy to push it out to the world that we have to have far stronger laws, but really the National Party and the Labour Party haven't been very good at all, and they've hidden so much stuff and they've allowed it to be because the old boy network still works in New Zealand.
Well, I mean, the thing that I know about overseas investment, the Act that governs that regime, they've got a provision that only dates back to the 1990s, it dates back to when Winston Peters was in government or in coalition with National, and they brought in a thing called a good character. The overseas investor had to be of good character. But it only applies to the individuals who, quote, own or operate or own or control the company. It doesn't apply to the corporations themselves. And so you get these companies, I mean, Kafka has routinely put in complaints to the Overseas Investment Office about specific corporations. I'm thinking of companies in the likes of waste management, some of the fishing companies, etc., got a terrible bloody track record. And the answer comes back, well, sorry, we can't look at the record of the companies, only of the people concerned, the individuals. That is now proposed to be changed in the Amendment Act or bill that the government is putting through now. So that will actually apply to companies as not just to individuals, but it's taken an awfully long time to get to that point.
It certainly has, and I'm very disappointed that New Zealand has dragged the chain so long, Murray.
Oh, you want to? Because it's enthusiastic. New Zealand has always been sort of happy to be sort of be an experimental laboratory for the rest of the world. We were the first country to sort of kick off the welfare state. We were the first country to sort of dismantle the welfare state under Rogernomics, etc. And so now you have sort of manifestations of that you associate with third world countries, like sort of homeless people begging in the streets and child poverty and people relying on food banks and all that sort of. In other words, a very unequal society.
It has.
Created, not even in my lifetime, in half of my lifetime.
I know. The flip has happened whilst, you know, we were present.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, astounding. Murray, look, I want to be able to just recap. You also been very much involved in the fact is that there are military bases in New Zealand.
Well, installations. I mean, bases brings up sort of connotations of
troops,
soldiers and fighter bombers and all that sort of stuff. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've just what Kin started off doing way back when in the 70s, and then we decided to concentrate on the economic side of things, and back in 1987, to be precise, the anti-bases campaign was founded. I mean, there have been a range of always US military installations. Some have gone, some are still here. Christchurch Airport, right here, since 1955, been a home for US military aircraft coming and going. Transport base, not a combat base, and it is specifically exempted from the nuclear free law. There's been a US military transport base at Christchurch International Airport since 1955, and it's still there today.
Yes.
A reduced sort of form is no longer as significant as what it was, but the one that gets the installation that gets all the publicity, and so it should, is the Waihopai Spy Base in Marlborough, which is theoretically a New Zealand base. It's operated by New Zealand Government Communications Security Bureau, which is New Zealand's electronic spying agency, and it's manned or personed, staffed by New Zealanders. So you and I, Tim, pay for the place, but apart from every other sense except that, it is essentially an outpost of US intelligence in New Zealand, and very specifically the United States National Security Agency, which is the world's biggest electronic spying agency. And you've heard this phrase, Five Eyes. New Zealand is the smallest of the Five Eyes. There's America, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And these are the sort of white Anglo-Saxon post-World War II electronic, or what used to be called signals intelligence, now electronic intelligence, buying allies. And an awful lot of New Zealand foreign policy is now predicated in those Five Eyes terms. There was some statement put out very recently condemning China for what it was doing in Hong Kong, and it was put out in the names of Five Eyes. Interestingly, New Zealand put out an identical statement by itself, and there are regular meetings between, they're probably not at the moment because of the COVID thing, but regular contact between all sorts of customs and police agencies, etc., of those five countries. So it's very much a working alliance, and one that is completely conducted behind closed doors.
That's right. Now, this is the thing, because they say that this program at the moment, you and I in this communication, we're being listened to. We would be recorded.
I mean, it's ironic that the front page of the Christchurch Press here on Saturday, I don't know whether it was in the Herald, it was all about ties between China and New Zealand politics. Specifically, in the press story was about China and Christchurch's mayor. That's fine, and I agree that we should have no truck whatsoever with interference in New Zealand politics by China. I mean, but for many a long year now, the United States has been quite heavily interfering with the collaboration of New Zealand politicians in the affairs of New Zealand. I mean, and before that, it was Britain, because New Zealand was a fully paid-up, loyal member of the British Empire. And then when that went west after World War II, or, you know, the aftermath of World War II, the Americans stepped into the breach and New Zealand attached itself to its coattails.
Yes, well, what I'm wanting to know is that they say that New Zealand spy agencies aren't spying on New Zealanders. Can I cut in?
Okay, the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service, the SIS, that's its job, is to spy on New Zealanders. I'm sitting in my office at home and I'm looking at several file boxes that are held on, they spied on Kafka, the organisation, for 25 years, and they gave us their censored version of the file, and they spied on me for that length of time also, and I've got a censored version of the file on me. But, okay, so them, but up until 6 or 7 years ago, the GCSB, Government Communications Security Bureau, were prohibited from spying on New Zealanders. They were supposedly only spying on foreigners overseas. But you recall a gentleman called Kim.com, and he revealed that he was being spied on, came out that he was being spied on by New Zealand intelligence, and which they shouldn't have been spying on him. He was a permanent resident. He was entitled not to be spied on. And there was a huge movement, if you recall, Tim, of tens of thousands of people marched through the streets in around about 2013, the Stop the GCSB Bill campaign.
Yes, yes.
Kill the Bill and all that sort of stuff. It went through by a couple of votes, one of them being Peter Dunn, who'd completely gone from Parliament, and thank God for that. And so what that did, the response of the Key government to the revelations that came out of the dot-com story, they didn't punish the criminals, who New Zealand spies who were exposed as having been spying on New Zealanders. No, no. The Key government legalised the crime and made it legal for the New Zealand Government Communications Security Bureau to spy on New Zealanders.
Yes, well, I have heard that New Zealanders spy on Australians, Australians spy on Canada, Canada spies on the UK, and the UK spies on America, and they can turn around and say, we don't actually spy on our own country spying on everybody else's country.
It's a phrase from Richard Nixon, actually. It's called plausible deniability.
I thought that was Admiral Poindexter actually said that.
Made it famous.
Okay, well, look, we're out of time.
And also my stomach is grumbling and telling me it's lunchtime.
Okay, well, look, Murray, I want to say thank you very much to your courage. I mean, it's some of us old guys are having to hang in there and do it because we're so needing of the young to step up.
Don't despair of the young. The young are very active on things like climate change, etc. When I started this off-term, the old guys looked with horror at us with our funny, bloody long hair and all that sort of stuff and our know-it-all attitude. And we took a completely different approach and different interest to what the old guard did in those days in the 60s. But, I mean, it's each generation gets very active on things that they're concerned about. I mean, look at this Black Lives Matter marches that took place just a few weeks ago. I didn't know anything about them because I'm not on social media. They got 20,000 people or something in Wellington, several thousand in Auckland, and even 2,000 or 3,000 during appalling weather in Christchurch. I mean, that's remarkable. In the middle of a pandemic response and an act of solidarity with things that are happening overseas. I mean, so that's hope. And last year, of course, all through 2019, you had thousands, tens of thousands of people marching in New Zealand organised by high school kids on climate change.
Yes, I know. But there's still huge gaps.
There are.
There are gigantic gaps.
My experience is you're not going to get young people are not by definition going to be particularly concerned about issues that are of burning concern to older people, like, for example, the state of the health system.
Yeah, look,
when you're young and fit and able-bodied, you don't think a hell of a lot about the state of hospitals and who's paying for it and all that sort of stuff.
That's right, you're bulletproof. Murray, we are so far out of time.
All right, okay.
Look, I want to say thank you again.
All right, and I hope that covered what Laurie wanted in her message.
Yes, I think so. So, look.
All right, righto, Tim, keep well.
Cheers, brother. Cheers.
Righto. Bye.
Thank you. That was Murray Horton of CAFCA, Campaign Against Foreign Control of Aotearoa, New Zealand. And you can get him cafca.org.nz. CAFCA.org.nz. I also wanted to ask him a number of questions, especially about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that Australia and New Zealand are signatories to the TPPA. And there are a number of other countries within the Pacific Basin who have signed up too. So therefore, they can come in and buy land. We need to clear this up. And also, selling off New Zealand's water. I really was a little bit disappointed that I didn't get that question out. Because for some unknown reason, this is not being spoken about in the public arena. This too is an election issue. An important election issue. We all need to follow this up. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it, spread it, radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 7.7 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 500 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And Lisa Eyre.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and hi.